From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, making diesel out of used coffee grounds. Also, harmonica player Corky Siegel, an old Chicago blues man who also plays with symphony orchestras. But first, today is the start of the new Chinese year. It's the year of the ox. Chinese people and others will celebrate the new year over the next couple of weeks. What does the ox mean? How is he celebrated? Joining us to answer those and other questions are two local experts on Chinese tradition. They are Alfred Lee, who's adjunct professor of Chinese culture and civilization at Sacramento State, and Rung Fong Su, who's chair for the Chinese New Year cultural celebration at Sacramento State, which happens in a couple of weeks. Alfred, Rung, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Alfred, what does the ox represent?
Oh, ox represents perseverance, diligence, hard work, down to earth. Is much different from the previous year, which year of the rat, which tends to be more spontaneity, more of seeking opportunities, you know, grasping the moment, whereas the ox tends to be more patient. And it typifies the animal.
I realize that these traditions go back an awful long time, but do you happen to know why some years are years of the ox?
Well, what had happened is the legend had goes like this. Before the Buddha left the earth, he decided to throw a banquet for all the animals in the world. But supposedly 12 animals just showed up. And as they arrived, that determines the order of the animals in the years. So some years of the year, the rat, the year, the ox. Then the following years, you have, the year of the tigers and the year of the hare and whatnot. Supposedly, there was a contest who would get there first, and the rat was able to convince the ox to ride on his back to make time. And then just as they're crossing the river, as the ox is reaching shore, the rat jumps off and gets there first, so he becomes represented first animal of the 12-year cycle.
Really? But the oxes?
The rat was.
Oh, the rat, I'm sorry.
Rat jumps off the ox's back. Rat has got to the shore. But then there's also a story that said that there was a cat on board. So there's actually 13 animals. But right before it got off the shore, the rat kicked the cat off the ox into the water. So from that point on, the rat and cat became mortal enemies, and the cat doesn't like water.
That's good. Rung, what determines the start of the Chinese New Year? Why does it start when it does?
I don't know that answer. I just look at the calendar, to tell the truth. I know it varies. I'm interesting myself, that why is it vary? I don't know.
Yeah, Alfred?
Oh, yes. It dates back to the lunar cycle. Supposedly, the winter solstice is on December 21st, 22nd, but right at the new winter solstice at December 21st, 22nd, the second new moon following that is the beginning of the Chinese Lunar New Year. And, of course, the moon varies year to year to year when it comes a full moon to new moon. So oftentimes the second new moon after the first winter solstice be anywhere from January 20th to February 20th. So it varies year to year to year.
Now, the Chinese New Year is celebrated over a relatively long time, about 15 days. The Chinese New Year celebration at Sacramento State happens on February 14th, which is some time from now. Rung, why is it spread over such a long period of time? Because in the Western calendar, New Year is celebrated on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, and then it's pretty much over. But the Chinese one lasts a lot longer.
Chinese like to play, huh?
I guess.
No, it's 15 days. I don't know. I'm guessing, Alfred, correct me if I'm wrong. Because the old days, the rural society, you did your harvest and nothing much to do. So they probably just celebrate. And then the 15th will be the brightest moon time, so the end of the celebration will ending with the Lenten festival.
Alfred, is that right?
Yes, it was a two-week celebration because you start with a new moon, which is dark sky, then it culminates after a two-week period into full moon, which was a lantern festival, brightness of the sky. Also, you have to figure it's also a combination. Chinese Lunar New Year is a combination of what Americans would be, Thanksgiving, Christmas and New Year. So this large celebration. It's a primary celebration for the Chinese society and people, culture. And they want to get the family together and be together the longest time possible. And the rest of the year, they're just too busy working. That's it. If anything else, they're going to take a day off in that period. But rest of the year, they work 7 days.
So it's a combination of all those big holidays?
Yes, for the Chinese. For the Chinese. That's how big it is.
Goodness. Then it deserves 15 days.
Rong, how do you think people in China are celebrating right now? I mean, I realize that the New Year celebrations last over 15 days, but but when it actually starts, I'm guessing that must be a particularly significant time.
So your question is,
how are people in China celebrating the New Year right now as it starts?
Well, I think they start from last night, New Year's Eve, big family dinner together with special family, you know, dinner, Chinese New Year food, like huo guo. The next morning,
which is?
Huo guo is hot soup with fire underneath in the old days. But nowadays, I think they just plug in an electric plate and keep boiling and keep cooking. You eat and you cook at the same time, almost like fondue, almost like American fondue. You have all the food there and you cook, you eat at the same time. Good family time. That's the night before. First thing, New Year Day, people all dress up nicely, go visit their families, relatives, friends, to say Happy New Year to them, wish them luck. And then the adults give the kids red envelope. That's the fun day I love. There's cash in the red envelope.
Yes.
I collect a lot when I was little. I missed that part.
And red is generally an important color. For our listeners' benefit, I should say you're wearing a very bright red jacket today. Is that because of the New Year?
That's right.
Yes. But there's no money inside the jacket, I guess.
No. You're putting a red envelope.
That's Rong Fong Su. She's chair for the annual Chinese New Year celebration at Sacramento State, which happens on February 14th. She's also co-founder of the Organization of Chinese Americans Greater Sacramento Chapter. And Alfred Yi is adjunct professor of Chinese culture and civilization at Sacramento State. He's also active in the community, helping to preserve Chinese culture in the region. Alfred, is it a big party on New Year's Eve? I mean, here in the Western world, it's really a big party night, New Year's Eve. People go out drinking and so on. The same in Chinese communities for the New Year's Eve?
Well, let me qualify that. What happens is that in traditional Chinese celebration, it's a family affair. You don't go out. You want the family to come together, the whole family, the complete family, a sense of unity, togetherness, and harmony. Well, with Western culture, like American, we go out and celebrate with strangers. But Chinese is a family of, like I said, to get together. Now, later on, they will go out and visit relatives and friends throughout the town or villages, wherever they come from. See, so it's a little different. And whereas American, let's say, will wish happiness and a happy new year, Chinese will tend to wish prosperity or whatnot for the coming year. A little more practical.
Yes. How do you wish prosperity in Well, I realize there are different languages in China, but how would you say it?
Well, I say Gong Hei Fa Choi, which is mostly Cantonese saying. But in recent times, the Chinese, modern Chinese in China and Hong Kong, Taiwan, has adopted the wishing of happiness, you know. Is that they literally would say Happy New Year, you know. Xin Nian Huo Lo, or Xin Nian Kuai Le, you know, depending on Mandarin.
Right. We'll say both. We still want prosperity.
In
Mandarin, we will say 恭喜发财 versus 恭喜发财. So there's some similarity. And then 新年快乐 means, how do you say it in Cantonese?
新年好, I believe what happened is that we do wish happiness, but then with the Chinese in Asia now celebrate both the American New Year, the Gregorian New Year, and the Chinese New Year. So they have a combination nowadays.
I thought that Mandarin and Cantonese were separate languages. Are they?
The pronunciation is completely different, but the writing is all the same.
I see.
That's how big China like that, with thousands of languages, dialects out there, we can communicate because we write the same thing.
Yes.
And we have Mandarin as a standard language.
I see. But I thought the words themselves were different, though.
The pronunciation of the word, sometimes the word order would be a little different. Basically, there are two major dialects, but the primary national language, it would be Mandarin, and the sub-language would be Cantonese, which occurs in southeast China. About 200 million Chinese speak that one. But even within the Cantonese dialect, there'll be hundreds of different sub-dialects. And in Mandarin, there'll be a few major dialects in the north. In fact, I have a friend at Sac State who recently retired. Sometimes when we went to China, and he speaks perfect Mandarin, he would take his own translator with him to speak the sub-dialects in northern China.
My goodness. But if you were to just walk all over China on New Year, what would be the safest expression to use so that everyone could understand you?
Well,
is there one?
What Rong Fang says.
新年快乐. Chinese, Happy New Year, is that what you?
Yeah, that was a New Year, be happy.
And that would be a safe expression pretty much anywhere in China. People would understand what you're saying there.
I think so. Actually, Mandarin in China, they call that 普通话. Everybody understands 普通话.
Yeah. We're talking about the Chinese New Year. It starts today. It's the year of the ox. Now, I was looking up about the ox, and you know, every 12 years, it's a different animal. And as it happens, the year I was born, 1961, was also the year of the ox. What does that mean about a person? What does it say about a person if they're born in the year of a particular animal?
Well, the year tends to imbue certain characteristics, you know. A person tend to be very powerful. A person born in a year of a rabbit, like myself, tend to be more sociable, more quiet. But you, as born in a year of ox, tend to be very diligent, hardworking, persevering. You were actually born the same year Obama.
Yes. He was born. August 61.
President-elected Obama was born, and also George Clooney and a few others, you know, and Meryl Streep.
Yes.
You know? So, good company.
And Rung, what year were you born, and what animal are you?
Oh, I'm going to keep that private.
Okay, we'll keep that one private. Alfred, do you know what the origin of the significance of the color red is in the Chinese New Year?
No, I don't know the origins of it, but the Chinese seem to just have adopted since the Shang Dynasty, as far as I know, or definitely since the Song Dynasty. Red, of course, means vitality, luck, energy, whatnot, and is worn throughout all celebrations, not only Chinese New Year, but through birthday celebrations and anniversaries and whatnot. It's a celebratory color to wear. It's very important.
As you reminded us, last year was the year of the rat. This is the year of the ox starting today. Next year is the year of the tiger. Is it better or worse to be any of those animals?
There's no particular animals. Every animal has their strengths and weaknesses.
Yes. Rung, in the New Year celebration at Sacramento State on February 14th, there's going to be a lion dance. What's the significance of the lion dance?
I think it's a lion dance. First, it's fun. It's exciting to watch them dancing. And traditionally, the origin was because the old days, they called that nian, it's some kind of devil. So the lion dance can scare the devil away.
I see. Well, that's good. And then there's going to be a ballroom dance in the evening. Is that a special Chinese ballroom dancing or
no,
is it Western ballroom
Western.
Dancing? Western. And why is that part of this Chinese New Year celebration?
Because we're Americans too.
The Chinese nowadays tend to adopt many aspects of Western culture and traditional culture. I think that's one of the strengths of Chinese culture is that they tend to accommodate and adapt. You know, they're willing to change. That's why civilization is more than 4,000 years old.
Yes,
they're not very hard fast. They will take the best of what they can find and make it part of their own.
Well, the Chinese New Year celebration at Sacramento State happens in the University Union on February 14th. It's the afternoon. Starts in the late morning, runs through the evening. Rung Fong Su is chair for that event. She's also co-founder of the Organization of Chinese Americans Greater Sacramento Chapter. And Alfred Yi, adjunct professor of Chinese culture and civilization at Sacramento State. Thank you both very much for talking with us about the Chinese New Year. The Year of the Ox started today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
Can I say something?
Very quickly.
I'd like to give 20 tickets to your audience.
We can't do that on our show. I'm sorry, we're a public radio station. Coming up, making diesel out of used coffee grounds. This is Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison, host of Insight. When you contribute to Capital Public Radio, you're helping support Insight and all the shows you listen to and rely on. Be generous today at 800-800-5867, capradio.org. Thank you. This is Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. One of the challenges in making biofuels is the fact that it often uses something, such as corn, that people would otherwise eat. And that's contributing to a worldwide rise in some food prices. So how about making fuel out of something that's already been consumed? Researchers in Reno did just that. They published their findings late last year. The food product they turned into biodiesel was used coffee grounds. Joining us is the lead researcher in this experiment. He's Manoranjan Misra, Professor of Chemical and Metallurgical Engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno. Manoranjan Misra, welcome to Insight.
All right, thank you. It's a pleasure to be in your program.
How did you get the idea to turn spent coffee grounds into biodiesel?
Well, I was, like you discussed before, people are trying to bring biodiesel from food material, like vegetable oil, canola oil, jatropha oil. I was thinking that we should take some waste material, convert to energy. One day I made a strong cup of coffee in the night about a year ago, and next morning I saw there's a thin layer of oil, you know, we call triglyceride, it's just floating. After that, I came to the university. I went to Starbucks with my students. We pick up 50 pounds of waste coffee. And then we started seeing there is 10 to 15% oil sitting in that waste coffee material.
I guess it's easy to forget that there's oil in coffee, but in this case, you had left it overnight, and so the oil had separated and was floating on the surface of the cup.
Yes.
So you decided to try and take this oil out of the coffee and then turn it into diesel. Is that an easy thing to do? Is it hard?
It actually, we take the ground coffee after they brew it. Then we extract the solvent. We take out the oil and convert that to biodiesel. It's actually a very easy process to make a biodiesel from oil.
If it's easy to do, why haven't people been doing it already?
Well, the conventional thought is, coffee beans has some oil. It's about 20% oil. But everybody thought when you roast the coffee beans and after you extract it, maybe the oil is gone. But that's not true. Still, you have a 10 to 15% oil is sitting there.
And is that considered a good percentage of oil to still be in a food product from the point of view of making biodiesel out of it?
Yes, it is. 10 to 15% is not a bad amount of oil. If you take a peanut, peanuts, or you take other vegetable materials, you have about 20%, 24% oil.
My guest is Manoranjan Misra. He was lead researcher in the experiment to make biodiesel out of spent coffee grounds. He's an engineering professor at the University of Nevada, Reno. Now, earlier I mentioned that one of the problems with using some food products to create biofuels is that you're using something that people would otherwise eat, and that's helped contribute to rising food prices. But another challenge is that sometimes it's not very efficient converting that food product into fuel. How efficient is the process of turning coffee grounds into biodiesel?
The coffee ground is already being processed. It's the waste material. So you are not trying to grow vegetable and then process it and make a biodiesel. This is coming from the material which goes to the garbage or they're sent to the garden. So actually it's much easier to extract from them, from that source, rather than from the original material.
I see. Well, that makes perfect sense. On the other hand, unlike corn, where you send in, big machines and they gather the corn and then you process it, this is the other way around. The coffee's already been distributed, and although there's no shortage of coffee grounds, they're scattered all over the place in small portions. How could useful amounts of coffee grounds be conveniently gathered?
Well, that's one of the logistic problems we have to look into, because there are, like Starbucks has 11,000 stores in the United States. And, how to collect the coffee, we have to probably use reverse logic, how the coffee goes to the store and then how it will come back to a central place. That's one problem. But if you look at the roaster where they roast the coffee, there are a lot of coffee they send to the waste material. So also, if you look at the instant coffee, they have a lot of coffee they processed at one place. So in addition to collecting coffee from the retail stores, we have also a huge amount of coffee in the, you know, a lot of central places. We can process it.
How much energy is there in this biodiesel made out of spent coffee grounds compared to other kinds of biodiesel?
Well, energy-wise, let me put it this way. If you take about 100 pounds of used coffee grounds, you will get about 2 gallons of oil, biodiesel. And that's the number we are looking right now.
I realize this could be kind of hard to calculate because
yes.
coffee grounds are spread out all over the place in the United States and around the world. But have you been able to calculate how much fuel could efficiently be made annually with the spent coffee grounds that are easily available?
You know, if you look at the total coffee, you know, that is one of the biggest, soft drink, I mean, or you call a hard drink that people yeah. use. It's about 15 billion pounds per year we use coffee. And if you do a conservative estimation, you can get about 200 to 300 million gallons of coffee, you know, biodiesel from that material.
Do you know how much of our America's diesel that would, is equal to?
Well, you that's a very good question. We consume, you know, very huge amount of diesel oil per year. You know, we consume 29 million gallons of oil per day in the world. And this coffee or even biodiesel, it's a very small fraction of the whole consumption. Our feeling is it will be somewhere between 5 to 10% of the, you know, diesel supply in the world. If you take a biodiesel from all the sources, including coffee. This is not a big amount, but it is a very small amount, but it can help in the long run to justify, you know, using alternate energy.
What do you think it would cost to make a gallon of biodiesel out of spent coffee grounds?
You know, we are trying to do a small-scale pilot operation, where we'll make about 25 to 50 gallons per day. And come out a realistic number. But at this time, we did some calculation. It is about $1 to $1 to $1.50 per gallon.
Well, that sounds pretty good, pretty competitive.
Yeah, if you compare that with other material, vegetable, you know, which is about $4 to $5 per gallon.
The thing, though, is that a lot of cars that are commonly driven in the United States, even ones that use diesel, or especially ones that use diesel, can't easily accept all kinds of biodiesel because biodiesel made out of things like corn or coffee has a different texture, I believe, than diesel that's made out of petroleum. Is this something that could easily be burned in cars?
You are right. You know, some of the diesel engines, you just can't use your biodiesel. It has to be, you know, you have to little bit change it or you have to convert it to biodiesel. But the biodiesel we are getting coffee, we found the calcitonin number, the number which shows how fast you're going to ignite. It looks very good. It's as good as actually it's better than diesel. And one more thing about coffee biodiesel is it has some antioxidants, so it's kind of stable compared to conventional biodiesel.
Manoranjan Misra was the lead researcher in the experiment to make biodiesel out of spent coffee grounds. He's an engineering professor at the University of Nevada, Reno. The research findings were published late last year. I was reading the report on your research, and one part that I really liked was the comparison of coffee oil with other waste feedstock from making biodiesel. And there's one column called Advantages, and one of the advantages of the coffee oil is that it has a pleasant smell. So, meaning what? That a car being powered with biodiesel made out of coffee would give off a sort of coffee smell?
Yes, it is very interesting. When you extract the oil, it's a very, you know, deep black color. It smells like it's just like coffee. Even after you do transform this oil to the biodiesel, the process called transesterification, it still smells like coffee. And so that's a nice thing. If you put in the engine, you burn, Your exhaust will probably, it will smell like you are roasting, brewing coffee in your house.
I've heard that the use of corn to make biofuels has driven up the cost of corn. Is there a risk that this could drive up the price of coffee?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it will drive up, because if you look at the Starbucks right now, they just put the coffee outside the door. You can pick it up and put in the garden, as a fertilizer. So I don't think we are trying to look at the waste product. So we are not using the raw materials.
Now, what about the grounds that are left over? After you've taken out the oil from the coffee grounds to turn into biodiesel, what about the grounds that are left over? Can they be used for anything?
Yes. Actually, our research is, we are working on that. And we take that, after you extract the oil, we make a fuel pellets. You can put in the, in your house, we heat it up like a wood-burning fireplace. And that is probably, giving you more money than you get from the biodiesel.
Wow. Finally, are there any companies expressing interest in developing this commercially?
I got about maybe, 50 or 60 emails from all around the world. The small and big coffee manufacturers, they are interested to get involved. And we are talking to a few companies right now, those who want to take the license from the university and go to commercial operations.
There was a story about your research in the New York Times. I guess that probably helps.
Yes, sir, it helps. And we are working with the Starbucks. We have a big roaster in Carson City, in Nevada, near Reno. So we are working with them and to start some pilot operations.
Well, and it'd be kind of nice, wouldn't it, if someone drives up to a coffee shop and their exhaust smells like coffee, and they buy a cup of coffee as they're sitting there in their car. It'd be kind of an interesting circle there.
It will be nice. You get a coffee, you get energy, caffeine, and you run the car also.
Well, thank you so much, Manoranjan Misra, Professor of Chemical and Metallurgical Engineering at University of Nevada, Reno, lead researcher in the experiment to make biodiesel out of spent coffee grounds. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for calling me. Thank you, sir.
Coming up, harmonica player Corky Siegel, the old Chicago blues man who also plays with symphony orchestras. This is Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison, host of Insight. I hope you'll keep Capital Public Radio on your list of organizations to support. We keep you up to date with what's happening in a sometimes bewildering world. Contribute, please, at 800-800-5867, capradio.org. Thank you. This is Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On tomorrow's Insight, radio host John Moe explains why his show, Weekend America, is going off the air. Plus, the bibliographer at one of the world's top wine and food science libraries, he's Axel Borg of the UC Davis Viticulture and Enology Collection. His job includes answering obscure wine and food questions from around the world. And the local author of the mystery novel Tibetan Adventure. The CD-DVD combo Chicago Blues Reunion brings together musicians who first made a splash in the 60s. They were all, of course, blues guys in Chicago. The disc set is, or rather was, one of the gifts in our fund drive. It was so popular, there are already none left. But we thought this was still a good excuse to listen again to an entertaining interview with one of the musicians on Chicago Blues Reunion. He's harmonica player Corky Siegel. Corky was in town for a concert with a symphony orchestra. I asked him what gave him the idea to fuse the blues and classical music.
Well, as I tell many people, the idea of juxtaposing blues and classical was neither my idea nor my fault. But it's certainly become what I do. In the early 60s, I started out in Pepper's Show Lounge. I was hired by Johnny Pepper to play every Thursday night at Pepper's Show Lounge. And I was just learning to play the blues. But it was basically so that Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Little Walter and all these great blues masters, even the young guys like James Cotton and Buddy Guy, would come and sit in, and I'd get to be on stage from 9 at night till 2, 3, 4 in the morning every week for about 9 months.
Wow.
And so I was like a blues guy. I was learning about the blues. And then a year later, 1966, I had put together the Siegel Schwall Band, and Seiji Ozawa used to come in night after night after night after night to hear us. He was a big fan. And one night he said, I'd like your band to jam with my band. And his band was the Chicago Symphony.
Yes.
Because he was the guest conductor at the time of the Chicago Symphony. And so he used to say, I must pursue this juxtaposition of blues and classical. And I never did, but it pursued me. And
had you been listening to much classical music at that time?
I was just a victim of the kind of music that would be played on the radio, and it could be classical, it could be anything, and I loved it all.
Yeah.
I was a willing victim of all kinds of music, and not specifically classical, no.
Well, going back to your childhood, what kind of music were you listening to then? What was your family interested in?
Yes, well, there weren't a whole lot of children's records. There was one children's record, and all the rest was symphonic or what I guess would be called pop music. But, you know, I'm 63, so we're talking, let me think of someone. I can't think. Well, Jimmy Durante. I don't know that name. Just but even before that, I'll think of him in a minute. I'm just really bad on names.
Well, when did you get into the blues?
It would have to be about 1964 when I put down my saxophone and picked up the harmonica and started learning harmonica. And then a neighbor came over and said, oh, you know, have you ever heard these blues players play harmonica? And he brought over a Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and Jimmy Reed record, and I fell immediately in love. It was like a year later that I'm playing at Pepper's.
That's amazing. How could that be? How is it that someone so early in his career as a blues musician could be playing with the guys who are at the apex?
Yeah, well, I think I know why I did it. I didn't know then why I did it, other than I really loved the blues. Now I understand there was, I felt like, you know, my parents always said this is a free country. You know, we treat people really well here and, you know, this and this. And then I'd look out the window and I'd see my, you know, black friends being treated terribly. So I sort of wanted to join that culture and be on the good side. You know, I think in retrospect, that was an underlying feeling. I think why a lot of kids like me ended up playing the blues or jazz. Not only is it an amazing culture, but I think we really felt like we wanted to support it.
You've got several harmonicas with you. How many different kinds of harmonicas are there?
Well, there's many, many different kinds of harmonicas. I basically play one kind. And the reason I have different ones is some of them are in different keys, and they also go bad very quickly.
Really?
So you have to have spares. It's just the reeds only last so long. They can only vibrate so long before they start going flat.
Yeah.
When they do go flat, you could tune them. But once you tune them, they're going to go flat much quicker. So you don't want to be in the middle of a performance and just have them go flat. So you throw them away or give them away or something, you know.
Now, just before we started this part of the program, you were quickly testing several harmonicas. What were you looking for or listening for?
I was trying to see if they were in tune.
Yeah.
And if all the reeds worked, because sometimes they get stuck and...
Okay. Which one passed muster?
These two here, I think, will be okay.
Okay. Tell us what. Just take either one and just let us know what key it's in.
Okay. This is okay. Let's do this one. This was in. It's a D harmonica. That's a D chord.
Yes.
But most blues players, as a matter of fact, all blues players play in what's called cross harp. So I'm actually going to play on a D harmonica in the key of A.
Okay.
So
what are you going to play
tonic
for us?
I don't know. Do you just licks? Or
yeah,
should I
absolutely
play a song? Or?
Yeah, something you played in Chicago with Muddy Waters.
Oh, wow. Well, that would be different. That's been like 45 years ago.
Yes,
so.
Sure.
Don't make me play that. Want me to play a tune?
Please.
Okay. I'm still warming up.
Hey, Billie Jean, what you doing down here? Just stomping your feet and chug-a-lugging your beer. Now, I've been trying all week long. I've been just getting ready to go back home. It goes on like that for a while then.
That is absolutely amazing. It looks like there's a lot of hard things about that, but what's the hardest thing about playing blues harp? What's the key to it?
The key to, well, to doing anything. My big talk is dynamics. Mm. But the key is, you know, basically the easiest instruments are the ones you don't have to know anything to play. So we have the piano. You could go over and just press the keys. So you have the harmonica. You breathe out, breathe in. So you really don't have to know anything to make sounds on it. So it's really an extremely easy instrument to play.
When it becomes blues, is it the wind control that's making it sing in a blues style, or is it the hands? Because your hands are all over the place.
Yeah, the hands aren't absolutely necessary.
Really? So what are the hands adding?
That was a hand. This is without the hand. So you could go.
When you're playing on stage with an orchestra, it's a small instrument.
Yeah.
Oftentimes when an orchestra is playing with an instrument, it's a piano. Or a violin, which is not that big, but it's still a lot bigger than a harmonica. Is it a struggle for the harmonica to be heard over an orchestra?
Matter of fact, one of the times I played a lot with the San Francisco Symphony. And one of the times I had written some works for the symphony, and we started performing, and all of a sudden they're playing like really, 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 really quiet. And I turned around, I said, you know, I got mezzo forte marked in the part. Is that mezzo? Well, we're trying to play quiet because you only have a harmonica. Of course, I had a microphone.
Now, on your CD, Corky Siegel's Chamber Blues, there's quite a lot of your work of fusing blues and classical. And we pulled a clip from one of them that I think illustrates it nicely. It's the first track called Unfinished Jump. And we'll listen to a bit of that, and then we'll talk about it. Mm-hmm. That's Corky Kathy Siegel with the West End String Quartet and the piece Unfinished Jumpets, Opus 13, from the Chamber Blues Suite by Corky Siegel. How did you write this piece of music?
One note at a time. Basically, one note at a time. You know, I said, okay, you know, this is what I do now. You know, I juxtapose classical and blues. I have the string quartet. I want the string quartet to stay in their idiom as much as possible. I want to stay in my idiom as much as possible. I just want to find ways for the two to work together. So that's conceptually the idea that is very exciting to me.
You know, and it works.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It really is. On the face of it, blues and classical seem to be so different. Are they really?
Not at all. That's the key. Is the reason we think they're different is because of we superimpose many socio-political ideas on the musical form. You know, for instance, we think blues. When we think about blues, we think a smoke-filled room. Mm-hmm. We think a guy beating on a guitar, you know, in jeans. When we think of classical music, we see an orchestra hall. We see a piano on high stick. We see people in tuxedos and evening gowns. But the music doesn't know about what people are wearing. And we think of, you know, classical music as sophisticated, you know, even with a little accent there. And we think of blues as hip, and we think of classical as square, and we think of blues as primitive. But the music doesn't know about those names. Once we just pull those away and we just look at blues and classical for what they are, they work together just like any other two forms of music. Because all the music we hear today at least came from another two forms of music.
What are the musicians and the blues fans that you started out with and the people who are still work exclusively in the blues, mm-hmm. what do they think about what you do with classical music?
Well, I have two frames of thought. You know, people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf totally would love this kind of thing because I spend a lot of time talking to them about, you know, music. They've always been very supportive. Then there's the musician. This is Corky. Why don't you, you're a blues musician. Why don't you play blues? And you know, I do a little bit, but my answer is, well, you know, juxtaposing blues and classical is dirty work, but somebody's got to do it. You know, if I didn't do chamber blues, there would not be chamber blues. So it's sort of up to me.
Are there many pieces of music for harmonica and orchestra?
There are pieces of music for harmonica and orchestra, but not necessarily that juxtapose blues and classical.
How do you mean?
Well, there's classical pieces. I know Larry Adler has performed with symphony orchestras. Bonfiglio. There's many harmonica players that have played with orchestras, but
there's no blues in it at all. It's just as another instrument playing with a classical orchestra, as if it were just a traditional classical instrument.
Yeah, I mean, let me just put it this way. I don't know of any pieces that are specifically blues concertos for blues harmonica. Mm. There may be by now, and I hope there are.
Yes.
Because it's really fun and really amazing. And, you know, classical music's traditions come from bringing in folk traditions into the classical music tradition. That's been the tradition of classical music. But so many years ago, maybe 50 or 100, it stopped doing that. Now we have this amazing folk form called blues, and it should be really part of the classical composition tradition to bring, well, I guess Gershwin did it. You know, Gershwin did it, but it's sort of, that's where it sort of stopped, you know.
And yet, for all your interest and your love for and your virtuosity in chamber blues, you still can rock out the traditional blues, as we heard at the beginning of the segment. Do you still enjoy playing traditional blues as much as you used to?
Traditional blues is absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. It's so much fun to play. It's just, it's mind-blowing. You know, but the interesting thing is that the performance styles of traditional blues are sort of this uninhibited, just getting out there and being physical. Well, really, all music should be that way. It should be uninhibited. You're expressing yourself. And it is that way. It's just when you start adding traditions, this is what you have to do to be called a classical player. This is what you have to do to, you know, oh, that's not jazz. You can't do that and call it jazz. You know, we start piling these traditions on, and what it does basically is it suppresses expression. It suppresses that uninhibited expression. So blues right now still sort of has that a little bit, you know, and it's a good example for other forms of music to go, hey, you know, we should really be, you know, having fun with this stuff. You know, Yo-Yo Ma does.
Yes. Corky, thank you so much for coming by and playing for us and talking with us. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It was great to meet you, Jeff.
I spoke with Corky Siegel on Insight in January 2007. I'm Jeffrey Callison, host of Insight. In-depth news and information programs like you hear on Capital Public Radio are expensive to produce, but we think it's worth the cost because you value these programs so much. Please do your part and contribute today at 800-800-5867, capradio.org. Thank you.